Livette has a gift for changing the subject at exactly the right moment. She's more tentative than her sister, but it's hard to remain standoffish with Luca there, all eyelashes and coy dimples. Lydia wriggles out of her backpack and retrieves a canteen. Not yet. They've made it a lot harder. Safety first. Rebecca discharges a puff of air that in another setting might pass for laughter. Yeah, Mommy shakes her head. Safety. You've been on the trains? Luca asks. Soledad twists to look at him, resting her chin on her shoulder. All the way from Tapachula, more or less. Luca thinks of the men running alongside the train in the clearing outside Lecheria, the way they ascended, one by one, and disappeared, while he and Mommy watched, unable to move. He thinks of the deafening roar and clatter of La Bestia, shouting its warnings into their hearts and bones while they watched, and he feels awed by these two powerful sisters. How? He asks. Soledad shrugs. We've learned some tricks. Mommy hands Luca a canteen, and he drinks. Like what? Mommy asks. We need some tricks. Soledad retracts her dangling legs and folds them beneath her, shifting her spine and shoulders into a stretched posture. And Lydia sees, even in this minor animation of the girl's body, how the danger rattles off her relentlessly. These sisters haven't befriended anyone since they left home. They too have kept to themselves as much as possible. But they haven't yet met anyone so young as Luca on their journey. Neither have they met anyone so watchfully maternal as Lydia. So it's a great pleasure to feel normal for a minute, to inhabit the softness of a friendly conversation. There can't be any harm in sharing some advice with their fellow travelers. Like this, Soledad says, gesturing at the tracks beneath them. One thing we noticed is they spend all that money on fences around the train stations, but nobody has thought yet to fence the overpasses. Luca watches Mommy's face as she surveys their position now from the angle of this new information. Mommy leans ever so slightly forward and gauges the distance to the ground beneath them. It's not that far. But then she tries to imagine how this space would change with the noise and weight and presence of La Bestia charging through it. You board from here? She asks incredulously. Not here, Soledad corrects her, because you'd hit your head as soon as you dropped. The overpass would knock you right off before you got your balance. We sit on this side to watch for it coming, but then you jump on over there, she points. Luca follows the direction of her gesture across the roadway, and he sees there, affixed to the guardrail, a bleached white cross with a burst of faded orange flowers at its center. Likely a memorial, he realizes, for someone else who attempted to board the train at this place and didn't manage it. He bites his lip. You just jump on top? Well, not always, Soledad says, but yes, if the conditions are right. You just jump on top. And what makes the conditions right? Lydia asks. Or wrong? Well, the first thing is you have to choose carefully where to do it. So this place is good, because you see, she says, standing and pointing across the roadway to the tracks beyond. You see the curve there, just ahead? Lydia stands too, so she can see where the girl is pointing. The train always slows down for a curve. When it's a big curve, it slows way down. So we know it'll be going slow when it passes. And then the next thing is to make sure there are no other hazards ahead. That's why we chose this overpass instead of the first one. Lydia looks south, back along the path they just walked. She hadn't even noticed that first overpass when they'd walked beneath it. She'd only been grateful for its momentary shade, a shallow respite from the sun. Because if you jumped on over there on that one, Rebecca adds, taking up the explanation for her sister, you'd only have a moment to get your balance before you'd have to hit the deck to pass beneath this one. Tricky. Lydia blinks and shakes her head. She can't envision it. So we sit here, Soledad continues. We watch. We wait for the train. And when we see one we like, we cross the road, we gauge the speed, we make the decision to board, and then we drop. Like going off a diving board? Luca asks, thinking of the water park at El Rollo. Not exactly, Soledad says. First, you lower your backpack, because it makes you top heavy, wobbly. So you toss that first. And then you squat down really low. You don't dangle, because if you do that, your feet will get going with the train, and then your top half won't catch up. You get stretched like a slingshot. So you roll your body up small and hop on like a frog, low and tight. And just make sure your fingers grab something right away. Luca's heart is hammering in his chest just thinking about it. He reminds himself to breathe. Then he looks at Mommy, taking it in, considering their likelihood of survival. He feels a sudden surge of manic energy coursing through his body. So he has to stand and spring and kick and let it loose into the world. If you get really lucky, sometimes the train might even stop, Rebecca says. And then you just climb down. Simple. But there's plenty of times we let a train go by too, Soledad says. If it's moving fast, we don't even try. We've already seen two people who tried to board and didn't make it. Lydia looks at Luca to see how this information will affect him, but he gives nothing away. Were those people boarding the same as you, from the top, like this? No, Rebecca seems almost proud. We're the only ones who board like this. I haven't seen anybody else do it. Lydia screws up her mouth. So these girls are either brilliant or insane. How many times have you done this? She asks. The sisters look at each other, and it's Soledad who answers. 5, maybe? 6? Lydia lets out a deep, low breath. She nods. Okay. You want to come with us? Rebecca asks. It's not until after the words are out that she glances at her sister, remembering they're always supposed to check with each other first about everything. Soledad touches the top of Rebecca's head, and the gesture reassures her sister in the language of their lifelong intimacy that it's fine. Maybe, Lydia answers, ignoring the hitch in her lungs as she expels the word. They talk a little while they wait, and Lydia learns that the girls are 15 and 14 years old, that they've traveled over 1,000 miles so far, that they miss their family very much, and that they've never been on their own before. They don't say why they left home, and Lydia doesn't ask. They both remind her of Yennefer, though it's probably only their age. The sisters are taller and more slender, darker skin than her niece, and both are luminous and funny. Yennefer had been studious and solemn. Even as a baby, she'd had a certain gravity to her. Lydia's older sister, Yemi, had selected Lydia, who was just 17 the year their father died, and Yennefer was born, to be the girl's godmother. Lydia remembers holding the baby over the baptismal font and crying. She made sure not to wear mascara that day so she wouldn't stain the baptismal dress. She'd known she would cry, not from joy or the honor of being the godmother or the emotion of the moment, but because her father wasn't there to see it. So Lydia's own tears had splattered across the child's forehead along with the holy water, and Lydia was surprised to see, through the blur of her vision, that the baby in her arms didn't join in her tears. Yennefer's eyes were wide and blinking, her mouth a perfect and puckered pink bow. Lydia loved that baby so much that she couldn't imagine she'd ever love her own child more. When Luca was born, years later, Lydia learned the incomparability of that kind of love, of course. But it was still Yennefer, that somber, shining girl who had allayed her grief when she lost the second baby. Wise little Yennefer at 9 years old, who'd cried with her and stroked her forehead and reassured her. "But you do have a daughter, Thea. You have me." The enormity of Lydia's loss is incomprehensible. There are so many griefs at once that she can't separate them. She can't feel them. Beside her, the sisters talk lightly to Luca, and he responds with his reanimated words. There's an effervescence among them that feels extraordinary. The sound of Luca's voice is an elixir. The sun feels hotter when they're sitting still, and Lydia notices that her arms are as tan as childhood. Luca, too, is a shade browner than usual, and there are dots of perspiration all along his hairline beneath Sebastian's cap. But the wait beneath the sapping sun is almost too brief, Lydia thinks. She could have used more time to talk herself into this. It's not even 2 hours before the distant rumble of the train grows into their consciousness, and all four of them rise without speaking and begin to ready themselves. In truth, Lydia's in no way convinced that they're actually going to go through with it. She hopes they do because they need to be on that train. And she hopes they don't because she doesn't want to die. She doesn't want Luca to die. She feels as if she's outside her own body, listening to that train approach, moving her backpack to the other side of the roadway, prompting Luca along in front of her. She packs her canteen into the front pocket of her backpack and sips it up. Even if she felt confident that she could jump onto a moving train, how can she ask her son to do this crazy thing? Her shoulders feel loose, her legs erratic beneath her. Adrenaline sluices all through her jittery body. Beside her, Luca follows a crack in the asphalt beneath his sneakers. He keeps his eyes and thoughts fixed on the minutiae. He leaves it to Mommy to take in the broad sweep of the task at hand. The dun-colored grasses and scrubby trees crowding the embankment, the dome of blue overhead, the overpass and train tracks intersecting like a cross. The wind fuzzes through Luca's hair as the noise of the train grows closer, the booming clatter and reverberation of those monster wheels hauling themselves along the metal of the track. The very loudness of that noise seems designed as a warning that enters through your ears but lodges in your sternum. Stay away. Stay away. Stay away. Don't be crazy. Don't be crazy. Don't be crazy. Luca holds his backpack by the top handle, low in front of him with both hands. There's one kid at school who's a daredevil. Her name is Pilar, and she's always doing crazy stunts. She leaps from the very top of the jungle gym. She flies from the highest arc of the swing. Once, she climbed a tree beside the school gate and shimmied out on an upper limb, from where she climbed onto the roof of the school building. She did cartwheels up there, until the principal called her abuela to come talk her down. But not even Pilar would jump onto a moving train from an overpass, Luca thinks. Pilar would never, in a million years, believe steady, rule-following Luca capable of participating in such madness. He watches the nose of the train approach and disappear beneath the southern edge of the roadway. He turns then and sees it emerge from beneath his feet. Mommy peers over the edge of the low guardrail just as the train pulls itself into view. "It's good," Rebecca smiles at them. "Nice and slow." "Ready?" Soledad says. Her little sister nods. Lydia's face is grim while she watches the girls. Luca studies the stretch of the train and sees a few migrants clustered near the tail end, on the last five or six cars. One is standing, silhouetting his body into an X, and he waves at them. Luca waves back. "Let's go," Soledad says. She and her sister line up beside each other, smack in the center of the track. They squat, holding their packs beneath them, and wait for the right car. They look for one that's flat on top, one that has the kind of grating you can walk on, sit on, grab onto. The first half of the train is all rounded tanker cars, so they wait. And then finally, quite slowly, Soledad tosses her pack and then follows it. With one graceful, chaotic, suicidal lurch, she moves her body from the fixed to the moving. She drops. Lydia can't tell how far it is. 6 feet? 10? And then the girl is instantly receding, her form growing smaller as she moves away with the train. Come on, she shouts back to her sister. Now! And then Rebecca, too, is gone. And Lydia realizes how quickly this has to happen, that they have no time to weigh their options, no time to consider best practices. She rejects the awareness that all her life she's been afraid she would jump accidentally, like that girl from her favorite novel, from cliffs, from balconies, from bridges. But now she knows with 100% certainty, she knows she would never have jumped. That fear had always been an elaborate trick of her mind. Her heels are glued to the roadway. A week ago, she'd have screamed at Luca to get back from there. She'd have told him not to stand so close to the edge. She'd have reached out and grabbed his arm to convince herself that he was safe, that he would stay put. Now she has to launch her child onto this moving train beneath them. The small cluster of migrants on the last few cars is approaching. They duck low to pass beneath the roadway, and then, when they emerge on the other side, they're facing Lydia, their arms open wide. They gesture at her to toss the backpacks. She tosses the backpacks, and then she grabs Luca by his two shoulders, stands behind him. Step over, she instructs him. Luca steps over without hesitation or objection. His heels are on the roadway. The toes of his little blue sneakers stick out into the air as the train passes beneath them. Luca hums to cover the dreadful noise of the train. Squat low, she tells him, just like the girls did. He squats low. If he jumps from this place and dies, it will be because he did exactly what Lydia told him to do. She feels as though she's watching herself in a nightmare, doing a monstrous thing that makes her panic. A thing, thank God, that she would never do in real life. And then, just as she's about to reel him in, to crush his small head against her chest, to wrap him in her arms and weep with relief that she wakened in time, she hears it. With conviction, Sebastian's voice, cutting through all the external and internal noise. The voice, then, when she opens her mouth and screams into Luca's ear, is almost not her own. Go, Luca! Jump! Luca jumps, and every molecule in Lydia's body jumps with him. She sees him, the tight tuck of him, how small he is, how absurdly brave he is. His muscles and bones, his skin and hair, his thoughts and words and ideas, the very bigness of his soul. She sees all of him in the moment when his body leaves the safety of the overpass and flies, just momentarily upward because of the effort of his exertion until gravity catches him and he descends toward the top of La Bestia. Lydia watches him drop. Her eyes so big with fear, they've almost left her body. And then he lands like a cat on all fours, and the velocity of his leap clashes with the velocity of the train, and he topples and rolls, and one leg splays toward the edge of the train, pulling his weight with it. And Lydia tries to scream his name, but her voice has snagged and gone, and then one of the migrant men catches him. One big, rough hand on Luca's arm, the other on the seat of his pants. And Luca, caught, safe in the strong arms of this train-topped stranger, lifts his moving face to seek her. His eyes catch her eyes. I did it, Mommy! He screams. Mommy, jump! Without a thought in her head except Luca, she jumps. Chapter 15. The year before Sebastián's murder, Mexico was the deadliest country in the world to be a journalist. No safer than an active war zone. No safer even than Syria or Iraq. Journalists were being murdered in cities all across the country. Tijuana, Ciudad Juárez, Chihuahua. And yet, because Los Jardineros didn't specifically target reporters the way most cartels did, Sebastián hadn't received an official cartel death threat for almost 2 years. So it's not quite accurate to say that Sebastián and Lydia felt a false sense of security. No one in Acapulco felt secure. The free press was a critically endangered species in Mexico. But in the aftermath of their discovery that Lydia's friend was La Lechuza, the absence of an explicit warning from him, combined with the fact of her fraught but genuine attachment to Javier, functioned as a sort of short-term analgesic for the worst of their personal fears. Sebastián continued to take the usual precautions. He avoided adhering too closely to a daily routine. He limited driving his recognizable orange Beetle to crime scenes, and whenever he wrote a particularly risky piece, he used the anonymous byline, staff writer, to conceal his identity. In those cases, the paper also sprang for a hotel room in the tourist district. He'd take Lydia and Luca, and they'd hunker down for a few days out of sight. When it appeared that retaliation was not forthcoming, they'd reemerge and continue with their lives. But those safeguards were largely illusory. Sebastián knew that any research he conducted, any crime he investigated, any source he contacted, was a potential landmine. He was as careful as a truth-telling Mexican journalist can be. For her part, Lydia became hyper-vigilant for any signs of danger. Javier continued to visit her in the bookstore almost weekly, and the torment she'd felt the first night she discovered the truth about him slowly gave way to something else. She still sat with him, served him coffee, spoke with him about a range of subjects. She listened twice more when he read her poems from his moleskin notebook. She even smiled authentically at him, and despite a sickening feeling of culpability and a reluctance to admit it, she was still charmed by him. His intellect, his warmth, his vulnerability and sense of humor, none of it had changed. Yet, when there was news of a fresh murder, which happened more infrequently than before, but not infrequently enough, Lydia experienced a sort of exaggerated emotional flinch, and she knew that her careful retreat from him was not only necessary, but also inevitable. Her behavior need only follow what her heart had already accomplished. "What if we tell him?" Lydia said to Sebastián the week before Jennifer's quinceañera. They dropped Luca at her sister Yemi's house earlier for a sleepover with Adrián. "Tell who what?" "Tell Javier about the article, before it comes out." Sebastián closed his leather menu and set it down on his plate. "Estás loca, mujer." She was buttering a warm roll from the covered basket and didn't look up at him. "Yes, but I think I'm serious, too." She pressed the butter into the bread and waited for it to soften. Sebastián looked away from her, out over the water. The restaurant was on a hilltop above the bay, and it was dusk, and he could see lights winking through the valley below, their ghost lights glimmering echoes in the water. He didn't want to consider the idea. He wanted to consider the view and the menu and his beautiful wife. After years of narco journalism, he'd become good at compartmentalizing, at putting all the ugliness away. Sebastián was skilled at enjoying himself, but he respected Lydia and didn't want to be dismissive. "If we talk about this for 2 minutes, do you promise then that we cannot talk about it for the rest of the night?" he asked. "Yes," she smiled and bit into her bread. "Okay," he said. "Why would we tell him? What's the benefit of doing that?" She took a sip of water. to gauge his response ahead of time, to know what we're up against? Sebastian sat very still while he listened. Maybe he'd even meet with you. You could get him to go on the record. Do you think he'd do that? I don't know, maybe. I mean, we know how smart he is. Maybe he'd see it as an opportunity to try and control the message, get some good PR, get out ahead of the curve. Every narco has a Robin Hood complex. Right, so you appeal to that. Maybe he'd even like it. But that's exactly what I'm afraid of. I can't be beholden to him. No, I know. But he might not know. He might think this means I'm his new PR guy. I'm on his payroll after this. Aye, Lydia grimaced. It's too risky, Sebastian said, opening his menu. What are you going to eat? Lydia read the article on Monday evening, the night before it went to press. She and Sebastian had to calculate the level of risk to determine their safest course of action for the coming days. The paper had offered to put them up in a hotel again, to get them out of sight. The piece would not be published under his name, but it would be easy enough to figure out who'd written it. Any one of his sources could reveal him to Javier. They already may have. Sebastian paced behind her while she read at the kitchen table from his laptop. La Lechuza Revealed, Portrait of a Drug Lord. The story was accompanied by several photographs. Sebastian and his editor had selected a flattering picture of Javier, sitting elegantly with his legs crossed at the knee, one arm draped across the back of a velvet couch. He wore dark jeans and a tweed blazer, and looked every inch the bookish professor, his eyes warm behind the thick glasses, his face smiling but not smug. Lydia thought again of the first morning he'd come into the shop. How deeply his friendship, his vulnerability, had affected her in the months before she understood who he was. She still felt reluctant to learn more unpleasant things about him. She still felt a memory of fondness for him, which unnerved her. She pressed her eyes closed and took a deep breath before she began. She was amazed by Sebastian's familiarity with his subject. He clearly knew a very different Javier than she did, and yet the account was both objective and compassionate. In her husband's words, she recognized her friend's intensity, but she also discovered for the first time the gruesome details of Javier's capacity for cruelty. The beheadings were only the beginning. Los jardineros were also known to dismember their victims and rearrange their body parts into horror show tableaux. According to Sebastian's report, during Los Jardineros' war with the previous cartel, Javier was rumored to have shot the two-year-old son of a rival while the boy's father watched. He'd painted the man's face with the blood of his murdered child. Those details had been mythologized, of course. There was no proof of that brutality. But when she read that, Lydia closed her eyes for nearly 3 minutes before she could continue. The article also highlighted the grisly statistics of Javier's ascension. During the transition of power, Acapulco's murder rate was the highest in Mexico and one of the highest in the world. The city hemorrhaged tourism, investment, young people, and that kind of bleeding was difficult to staunch even after the violence tapered off. It was also true that though the bloodshed had become less visible to the average citizen in recent months, there were still a dozen or more murders in the city each week. In addition to those numbers, countless more had silently disappeared. The very essence of Acapulco had changed. Its people were permanently altered. Entire neighborhoods were abandoned as people fled the rubble of their lives and headed north. For those who left, El Norte was the only destination. If a tourist mecca like Acapulco could fall, then nowhere in Mexico was safe. The profile drew a bright line between Javier's ascent and the truth of the city's ruin. It was a brutal new cosmopolis, and its ugliness was underscored by the memory of Acapulco's glorious past. Sebastian's account was heartbreaking, unvarnished, and utterly convincing. It also credited Javier with a dawning peace, commended the control he exercised over his men, and appealed to him for continued restraint. It ended with a psychological profile of the man himself, and as Lydia read it, she knew it to be exactly true. Unlike his contemporaries and predecessors, La Lechuza was not flashy, gregarious, or even particularly charismatic. He seemed enlightened, but like every drug lord who's ever risen to such a rank, he was also shrewd, merciless, and ultimately delusional. He was a vicious mass murderer who mistook himself for a gentleman, a thug who fancied himself a poet. The article ended with the inclusion of a poem written by Javier himself, and Lydia's mouth dropped clean open when she saw it there in print. She knew this poem, the first one he'd ever shared with her. "How in God's name did you get this?" she whispered. Sebastian stopped pacing long enough to lean over her shoulder. Lydia read the poem again, even more terrible printed there on screen than it had been when Javier had entrusted it to her. "Oh yeah," Sebastian said. "That was crazy. You know we run that annual poetry contest? His daughter, Javier's daughter, sent it in. She submitted it on his behalf. I guess she wanted to surprise him."
"Wow," Lydia said. "Marta."
The inclusion of the poem was mortifying. It served to coalesce all the facts into a vivid portrayal and to corroborate, somehow, the accuracy of Sebastian's description. As she closed the browser and leaned back in her chair, Lydia discovered that there were many different ways to feel horrified at once. "Well?" Sebastian shoved his hands into the pockets of his jeans and leaned back against the kitchen counter. He was barefoot, and his socks were twisted into a small heap on the counter behind him. Lydia stared at those socks. "What do you think?" She folded her hands beneath her chin and shook her head.
"I think it's fine."
"Fine? Not good?" "No, I mean, it's good." "It's good, Sebastian." "I'm not talking about that. I mean, I think it'll be fine with Javier." He nodded at her. "Okay." They were quiet while she contemplated further. "In fact, I think it will be better than fine with Javier. I think he'll like it. It's fair. More than fair, almost flattering." He nodded some more. "You feel confident?" Again, she waited a moment to make sure her answer was true before she said it. "Yes." Sebastian went to the fridge, retrieved two beers, twisted off both caps, and set one down in front of his wife. "I'm not gonna lie. I'm a little nervous." He tipped the bottle into his mouth and drained half at once. "I'm relieved you feel good about it, though. You're sure it's okay?" He watched Lydia twist her brown bottle in circles on the table. "You don't think we need to disappear for a few days, just to be on the safe side?" She knew how important it was to be sure. She didn't fling the answer out recklessly. She measured it first, and then,
"No, I think we're fine," she said.
100%?
"Yes, 100%.
She closed the laptop and pushed it away. Sebastian was leaning against the counter. He hadn't shaved that morning, and there was a shadow of stubble across his chin.
"Are you surprised? You think it's too sympathetic?" he asked.
"No, I mean, it's still horrifying," she sipped from the bottle. "But accurate. You show that he's human. So as far as the truth goes, I think he'll be pleased." That was a Monday evening less than 2 weeks ago. Lydia remembers it was Monday because she'd just brought Luca home from football practice and he'd been hungry, so she'd given him a slice of toast and a banana, even though he was late getting to bed.
He tracked dirt into the hallway because he forgot to take his cleats off at the door, and Lydia had been annoyed because she'd just swept. Less than 2 weeks ago, dirt on the floor in her hallway was a thing that could annoy her. It's unimaginable. The reality of what happened is so much worse than the very worst of her imaginary fears had ever been. But it could be worse still, because there is still Luca. On top of the train, Lydia takes two of the canvas belts from her pack and secures one through the back belt loop of Lucas's jeans before threading it through a metal loop atop the grating where they sit. Then she belts herself to the top of the train in the same way. She doesn't know if that small strap of canvas would actually do much to save Luca, should he fall. All she can do is try. She imagines that most accidents happen when migrants are trying to get on and off the trains anyway. Her feet smart in a way they haven't since she was a young girl leaping from the swings at a full arc, when she'd land with a thud and feel that echo of tenderness reverberate up her legs. They're sore, but it's not a bad pain. It's only a reminder that she's alive, that her legs can be used like pistons and springs, that her feet can still make a racket beneath her. She flexes one leg and then the other, bangs her feet against the metal grating to loosen the ache. Rebecca and Soledad are a few cars ahead of them because they jumped earlier, but soon the girls make their way back to them, stepping along the tops of the freight cars, leaping across the gaps, ducking flat when the train passes beneath a roadway. Lydia performs a series of elaborate flinches while she watches them. Soon they're all seated together, along with the four young men who were already here, including the one who caught Luca when he jumped. Lydia watches the men react to the girl's arrival. She studies their faces as, one by one, they absorb the circumstance of the girl's extreme beauty, and one by one, they shift their bodies ever so slightly away from the teenage sisters. The men are deferential. They know what hardship lies along the road for these girls, and they're sympathetic to that danger. Soon they all move past it. The men smile at Luca. They tap him and point out interesting sights as they pass. A mother cow with her calf, a huddle of trees like a rugby scrum, a stark white cross atop a low hill. The men bless themselves when they go by a steeple or a roadside grave. They pray. Those first few hours on La Bestia are exhilarating. The train ambles west and west and north, and Luca feels a giddy sense that they are really going now. It feels so good to be a passenger, to make fast progress with the power of machinery doing the work. They drink water from their canteens and eat granola bars. Lydia gives one to the sisters to share. Soledad and Rebecca sit back to back, their knees propped up like tent poles. Soledad eats her half in one gulp. Rebecca savors hers, picking crumbs from the corners and allowing them to dissolve in her mouth before swallowing. The landscape rolls beneath them, shifting colors. Sometimes the trees draw close to the tracks, squat and scrubby. Sometimes they stand back and pierce the sky. Sometimes obstructions press in at the top of the train and threaten to knock the passengers off. Overgrown foliage, the narrow structure of a bridge crossing over a ravine, and most alarmingly, the cramped tunnels where the ceiling seemed to skim just inches above their heads, and the echo of a deafening noise amplifies the fear of falling. The migrants are alert to these dangers. They crouch, flatten, lean. They draw their arms and legs in and hold their breath. Periodically, the train stops, and after a while, Luca begins to understand how to predict those interruptions. First, there will be an abrupt change of direction. That means there's a town nearby, large enough that whoever laid these tracks determined the train should go there. The train turns and lurches, slowing first for the change of direction and then further as the town approaches. The migrants shift into postures of alertness, make themselves flat atop the cars, so Luca and Lydia do the same. They watch for the dark trucks and white stars of La Policía Federal, whose job it is to clear migrants from the trains. What happens if we see La Policía? Luca asks. He's lying flat on his stomach, stretched out between Mami and Soledad. Soledad faces him and rests her ear in the crook of her elbow. You run for your life, chiquito, she says. Sometimes the stops are brief, a few minutes. Sometimes they last an hour or more, while the migrants hold their collective breath, their muscles taut, their senses strained. Their eyes comb the landscape for movement beyond the men loading and unloading freight from the hollow cars beneath them. Sometimes the working men throw snacks up to the migrants on top of the train before it leaves, or refill their water bottles from a nearby hose. Other times, it's as if the men have been warned not to aid the migrants, like they're invisible on top of the train. And those times are like careful choreography, all pretending not to see or be seen. And then, at last, there's a whistle, a jerk, and the gradual acceleration of relief as the train resumes its journey to the next place. When the light descends to that golden glowing hour, when it touches Soledad's skin like an uninvited spotlight, the sisters put their heads together and talk quietly for a few moments. We don't stay on the trains at night, Soledad explains to Lydia after. We'll get off at the next place, Rebecca adds, whenever it stops again. Lydia nods. She doesn't ask why. We'll get off then too, right, Mommy? Luca asks. It feels like the sisters have invited them, indirectly, to go with them. Rebecca looks to Lydia, the girl's face nearly as hopeful as Luca's. Soledad is harder to read, turning askance so Lydia can see only her profile. Lydia's loath to get off after the difficulty boarding. Now that they're finally moving, she'd like to stay on the train all the way to El Norte. But on the other hand, it's precisely because of these girls and their instructions that she and Luca managed to get on La Bestia at all. They've returned Luca's voice to him. They know things. Okay, Lydia says. When the train stops at San Miguel de Allende just before sunset, Luca and Lydia follow Soledad and Rebecca down the ladder. They wave goodbye to the men who remain behind, and wave hello to the men who are opening one of the freight cars to unload the waiting cargo. They set off quickly into the town. San Miguel de Allende is immaculate, with low stone walls lining the streets and manicured trees and flowers in the plazas. They follow a wide avenue as it swoops past a pink church, rosy in the setting sun, with pennant flags strung festively from the facade to the front gates of the churchyard. Luca can still feel the leftover vibration of the train in his bones as they walk. The concrete underfoot has a new sensation of active stillness. They pass a furniture store, a pharmacy, a bar, a fancy house with balconies, three men loitering beneath a palm tree, causing the sisters to quicken their steps. They pass new houses of stucco and old houses of stone, a supermarket, a football field, a woman begging on the street, a nicer supermarket, and finally, a roundabout that seems to demarcate the downtown's edge. The sisters walk by instinct, and they've become good at it, following the signs and the people, wending their way into the denser parts of town in search of La Plaza Central. They feel safest where it's clean and crowded. A hotel, a hardware store, a bus station, a statue of a winged angel attacking somebody with a sword, and the daylight descends from pink to purple. Beside a fruit vendor, a man sits astride a milk crate wearing a white cowboy hat. His accordion grows and shrinks in his hands like flamboyant lungs. He makes the music the whole street moves to. A lady is grilling meat nearby, and the aroma makes Luca's stomach twist in hunger. But they keep walking as the streets become narrow instead of broad, stone instead of tarmac. Paper lanterns stretch across the spaces overhead, affixed to the wrought iron balconies and bobbing in the urban breeze. It's different from Acapulco in every conceivable way except one. It's like a sensory postcard of a Mexican town. The sun sets west at their backs, making everything blush. Luca squeezes his mother's hand.
Mami, I'm hungry.
Good timing, chiquito, Soledad says. We're here. Here is the Plaza Principal of San Miguel de Allende. They duck beneath the arched stone portico of a cinnamon-colored building and take a moment to rest. Luca lets go of Mami's hand and leans his pack against the wall behind him. In the plaza, people are eating tortas and drinking Cokes. They're chatting and laughing. Three mariachi bands in competing colors, orange, white, powder blue, keep just enough distance between them to be heard above their rivals. They stroll the corners of the plaza and romance the tourists with the brightness of their music. There's a band of odd trees that fills the square between them, their trunks tight and compact. The weird spread of their limbs above blends their foliage into one thick, spongy green ceiling. A riot of pink spires, topped by a golden cross, rises from the canopy like a fairy palace. It's the Parroquia de San Miguel Arcángel, and the church makes a stunning silhouette against the dusky sky.
Crazy!
Rebecca says the word they're all thinking. It's one of the strangest places Luca has ever seen. And just as the last ray of sunlight lifts diagonally from the Plaza Principal and slides up the steeples on its way out of town, all at once, the studded lampposts blaze to light. The strings of lights around the tree trunks pop and glow. It's overwhelming to be in a beautiful, festive place like this. Lydia is overcome by guilt, because it feels incongruous and seductive and wrong to witness the simple charm of a pretty place. She can see that same kind of notion land across Luca's features, and she reaches for his hand. His mind does this awful thing to remind him not to be enchanted. It floods him with a helpful memory of all his dead family, the endless roll of gunfire through Abuela's bathroom window, the screams outside, the futile press of Mami's hands against his ears, the single spot of his bright red blood against the green shower tile. Everyone gone. Luca is gone with them for a moment, so he doesn't hear Mami when she says his name. He doesn't see the faces of Soledad and Rebecca swarm toward him in sisterly concern. He's unaware of his own sobbing, the way he clamps his hands over his head. He doesn't know how long he's gone, but when he returns, he's tucked in the curl of Mami's body, and she's rocking him. Her hands through his hair, her voice, a hum of tight comfort in his ear.
Shh, amorcito, it's okay,
Lydia says. He nods.
I'm sorry, I'm okay now.
But she doesn't let go. Soledad catches Lydia's eyes across the top of Luca's head, and some byway of recognition darts between them. They perceive each other, the unspoken trauma they've both endured, their reasons for being here. It's as subtle and significant as a heartbeat. And then Soledad says,
Rebecca, let's hurry now and get him some food. Figure out where to sleep.
Lydia funnels gratitude into the slow blink of her lashes. The sisters return quickly with dinner. It's like a magic trick, so that Lydia can see for the first time some benefit to their beauty. It's the best food Luca and Lydia have eaten since the quinceañera, because the sisters have learned important things. They don't bother with the street vendors, whose generosity might be contingent on feeding their own families first. Instead, Soledad and Rebecca have learned it's best to find a fancy restaurant and befriend a young man there who may emerge for a cigarette break or to make a delivery.
The young man may find himself beholden to the beauty and raw need of two young girls who are alone so far from home. Very often, the sisters have learned, that young man will disappear momentarily and return with two heaping containers of hot spaghetti, still steaming and tossed with garlic, oil, and salt. Perhaps there may also be a spoonful of bolognese or some vegetables, a heel of warm bread. There is always a smile, a blessing, a flare of recognition from the hardworking young man, who, because of the way beauty begets empathy, among other things, imagines his own little sister or cousin or daughter in the place of these girls. He bids them a safe journey, implores them to look after themselves. Sometimes he also provides forks. The girls are always effusive in their thanks. They call all of God's blessings down upon the young man's head. On the broad pink steps of the elaborate church, Luca and Lydia, Soledad and Rebecca, fall gratefully on the spaghetti. They eat in silence, sharing the two forks, until every morsel is gone. Lydia thanks the girls, and her spoken gratitude feels entirely insufficient, because what she really needs to say is that the food, yes, but also their kindness, their humanity, their very existence, has nourished some withered, essential part of herself. Rebecca and Luca have wandered over to rinse their hands in the fountain, but Soledad is looking directly at Lydia's face. "Maybe we should stick together for a while," she says. Lydia nods. "Yes." Night collapses over the city. The bars and restaurants empty and shutter their doors for the night, and eventually, even the lingering mariachis disperse to their homes. As the lights of San Miguel de Allende falter and quench, the four travelers move their packs and their bodies toward the center of the plaza. They stretch themselves out on the municipal benches, like bums, Luca thinks. It's their first night sleeping outdoors, and it doesn't feel like an adventure at all. He wants his bedroom with its stack of books on the floor and his ballon de football lamp. He wants Papi's warm shadow on the wall. But his belly is full and his head is resting on the squishy part of Mami's thigh, and Luca is exhausted. There's a tug of war in his heart already, between wanting to remember and needing to forget. In the months to come, Luca will sometimes wish he hadn't squandered these early days of his grief. He'll wish he'd let it pierce and demolish him more. Because as the forgetting part takes anchor and stays, it will feel like a treachery. He'll mistakenly believe it's his own cowardice erasing Papi's details. The mole above his left eyebrow, the tight, rough little curls of his hair, the timbre of his voice when he laughs, the sandpaper feel of his jaw against Luca's forehead when they read together at night in Luca's bed. But Luca doesn't know any of that yet. Nor does he know that no matter what he does right now, that creeping amnesia is inevitable. It's not his fault. So, in fatigue, he pushes those memories away and shuts them out. He recites to himself the geographic particulars of Nairobi, Toronto, Hong Kong. Soon he's snoring softly on his mother's lap. Despite her bone-deep exhaustion, Lydia's the only one unable to sleep. She stiffens when a young couple approaches, tipsy and giggling. They steal beneath the trees for a kiss and then stop in their tracks when they see the darkened silhouette of Lydia sitting up on the bench, her backpack clutched in front of her like a shield. The sleeping figures of Luca and the sisters nearby. The children don't stir, and the couple quickly retreats. Behind the noise of crickets, their footsteps echo and diminish. Lydia envies the chorus of shuffling breath around her. How easily young people can slip into their weariness like a warm bath. She used to do that too. She remembers before she was a mother. She could do anything back then, before she had maternal fear to spark any real caution in her soul. She'd been reckless in her youth. As a teenager, she'd dived from the cliffs of La Quebrada, just for the thrill, for the quaver that jolted through her when she leaped. She shudders now at the memory of that unnecessary danger and turns to look at the sleeping girl stretched head to head on the next bench over. When at last a dim light begins to creep through the canopy, signaling the coming safety of daylight, Lydia's mind releases her to sleep. Chapter 16. The joke at home had always been that Luca and Sebastian shouldn't talk to Lydia until she was well into her second mug of morning coffee. She always had two at home and a third in the shop when she opened. She got into the habit of cleaning the filters and filling the carafe at night, so she wouldn't have to contend with all that in the morning when she was still half asleep. It was the first thing she did each day when her alarm went off, on her way to the bathroom. She'd flip the power switch on the coffee maker and feel a gurgle of happy impatience when the red light came on. On Sundays, when she had extra time, she'd steam milk for froth or brew the grounds with cane sugar and cinnamon for café de olla. Now there's no coffee at all most mornings, which triggers a daily headache, made worse when Lydia is exhausted from lack of sleep. They return to the tracks early, and there are a dozen or so other migrants gathered there waiting for the train. Nearby, a man wearing nice jeans and a clean collared shirt stands at the back of a pickup truck with a tailgate folded down. Inside, there's a huge pot of rice and a cooler stacked with steaming tortillas. He's the padre from the trackside church with the pennant flags, and before he feeds the migrants, he offers them communion and gives a blessing. Then he fills the tortillas with rice and hands them out. He also has a big orange barrel that says Gatorade, even though it's fruit punch. One of the other migrants fills paper cups and hands them around to whoever's thirsty. Lydia and the girls sit on the benches and eat in silence. It's Luca who notices.
"Why are they waiting on that side of the track?" he points.
"Huh?" Lydia says, chewing. The migrants are gathered on the southbound side. Rebecca takes her tortilla with her as she walks over to the waiting men. She speaks with them and then returns to explain. "We've missed the Pacific route," she says.
"What?"
Soledad sounds alarmed. "Not by much, don't worry." Rebecca sits down beside her sister. "Only an hour south of here, Celaya."
"Ah, the third largest city in the state of Guanajuato,"
Luca interjects quietly. Both girls turn to gawk at him, and he slurps his fruit punch, embarrassed. Rebecca continues,
"So we can ride the train south and change at Celaya for the Pacific route."
"But why?" Lydia asks, sitting forward. "Isn't it shorter if we go this way?"
"It's not safe," Rebecca says.
"Our cousin told us." "Everyone told us," Soledad corrects her. "Everyone told us we have to take the Pacific route. All the other routes are super dangerous because of the cartels." The food is pasty in Lydia's mouth.
"Everyone says the same thing," Soledad agrees. "Only the Pacific route is safe."
Lydia doesn't need to be convinced, but she does have a question. The girls seem to know a lot more than she does.
"Do you know which cartels run which routes?"
"No, but God is watching out for us," Rebecca says. She makes the sign of the cross. "We will be okay." Just to make sure, the sisters go into the church to light a candle while they wait. When the southbound train comes through San Miguel de Allende, it doesn't stop, but it's traveling slowly and the gathered men all board with ease. Luca watches the sisters jog along beside the train. Their fear makes them graceful and strong, their movements precise. Men wait at the top of the ladder to grab their hands and haul them onto the roof. Luca will not be left behind. He runs, and Mami with him, and he feels very brave until just at the moment when he grabs onto the advancing ladder. And the cursory vibration echoes into the palm of his hand and all down into the bones of his body,
and that reverberation reminds him how small he is, and how colossal the train is, and how dead he would be if he let go at the wrong time. Mommy's behind him, and she boosts him from the backside, and he grips the ladder so hard his knuckles turn colors, and he's almost afraid to let go with one hand so he can climb up to the next rung. But he knows he must, because he has to make room for Mommy. So he climbs, and the fear is like a balloon in his throat. But now there are two men at the top, and one reaches down and grabs him by the backpack, and the other by his upper arm. And now he's on top of the train, and Rebecca is smiling at him, and here comes Mommy over the edge. They did it!
¿Qué más hizo, chiquito?
Rebecca is impressed. He grins. Luca has never liked a girl before. Okay, that's not exactly true. Because he liked daredevil Pilar from school, because she was really good at football. And he likes his cousin Jennifer because she was nice to him like 85% of the time, even when she was mean to her brother. And he liked this one girl, Miranda, who lived in the same apartment building, because she wore bright yellow sneakers and could make her tongue into the shape of a shamrock. So maybe it's more accurate to say that Luca's never been in love before. On top of the train, Luca watches Rebecca and tries to act like he's not watching Rebecca. Not that anyone would notice anyway, because everybody's too busy watching Soledad to notice anything else. In the half-light left over from Soledad's corona, Rebecca glimmers like a secret sun. She's stretched out on her back next to Luca on top of the train.
So why'd you guys leave home? She asks him.
Luca grinds his teeth and tries to formulate an answer quickly, before she can feel bad for having asked, but he can't think of anything to say. You're running from your dad? She guesses.
No. Luca says. Papi was great.
He rolls onto his side so he can look at her, even though that means his arm is no longer stretched alongside hers.
Are you a spy? She asks. I won't tell anyone, I swear.
She's holding a piece of cardboard over her face for shade, and her black hair is all looped through the holes in the metal grate beneath them.
Yes, Luca says. I'm a spy.
My government received a tip about a nuclear warhead on this train. I'm here to save the universe.
Thank God, it's about time, Rebecca laughs.
The universe needs saving. The train rocks unevenly beneath them. Nearby, Mommy chats quietly with Soledad.
What about you? He asks. Why did you leave home?
Sigh, Rebecca frowns. She actually says the word suspiro instead of sighing, which is funny despite the unhappiness of her expression. Everything was bad in the end, she sits up. Soledad is super pretty, you know? She lifts the cardboard to the side of her face where the sun is.
Is she? I didn't notice,
Luca says.
Payaso,
Rebecca laughs and uses the cardboard to swat him on top of the head. Anyway, we come from a really small place, only a little scrap of a village in the mountains. Or not even a village, really, because of how stretched out it is. Just a collection of different tucked away places where people live. And it's a really out of the way place. The city people call it a cloud forest, but we just call it home.
Why cloud forest? Luca asks.
Rebecca shrugs.
I guess because of all the clouds.
Luca laughs.
But every place has clouds.
Not like this, Rebecca says. In my place, the clouds are not in the sky. They're on the ground. They live with us in the yard, sometimes even in the house.
Wow.
Rebecca half smiles. It was always soft there, enchanted. And there was no cell service or electricity in the house, or things like that. And we lived there with our mommy and papi and abuela. But it was pretty impossible to make a living in that place because there was no work, you know? Luca nods. So our papi, he was mostly away, living all the time in the city in San Pedro Sula. In his head, Luca thinks San Pedro Sula, second largest city in Honduras, 1.5 million people, murder capital of the world. Out loud, he says, "Ah, you are an Honduran."
"No," Rebecca corrects him.
"Chorti."
Luca makes his face into a question. "Indian," she explains. "My people are Chorti."
Luca nods, even though he doesn't really understand the difference. "Anyway, Papi was a cook in this big hotel in San Pedro Sula, and it was almost a 3-hour journey by bus from where we lived. So he only came home maybe once every couple of months to visit us. But that was still okay, because this place, our little cloud forest, even though we missed our puppy, it was the most beautiful place you've ever seen. We didn't really know that then, because it was the only place we'd ever seen, except in pictures and books and magazines. But now that I've seen other places, I know. I know how beautiful it was. And we loved it anyway, even before we knew. Because the trees had these enormous dark green leaves, as big as a bed, and they would sway in the wind. And when it rained, you could hear the big, fat raindrops splatting onto those giant leaves. And you could only see the sky in bright blue patches if you were walking a long way off to a friend's house or to church or something. When you pass through a clearing and all those leaves would back away and open up and the hot sunshine would beat down all yellow and gold and sticky. And there were waterfalls everywhere with big rock pools where you could take a bath and the water was always warm and it smelled like sunlight. And at night, there was the sound of the tree frogs and the music of the rushing water from the falls and all the songs of the night birds. And Mami would make the most delicious chilate. And Abuela would sing to us in the old language. And Soledad and I would gather herbs and dry them and bundle them for Papi to sell in the market when he had a day off. And that's how we passed our days. Luca can't see it. He's there, far away in the misty cloud forest. In a hut with a packed dirt floor and a cool breeze with Rebecca and Soledad and their mami and abuela. And he can even see their father far away down the mountain and through the streets of that clogged, enormous city wearing a long apron and a chef's hat and his pockets full of dried herbs. Luca can smell the wood of the fire, the cocoa and cinnamon of the chilate. And that's how he knows that Rebecca is magical, because she can transport him 1,000 miles away into her own mountain homestead just by the sound of her voice. "The clouds were so thick you could wash your hair in them," she says. "But then one day something awful happened, because we were so isolated up there in our place. So when the narcos came through and all the men from the village were gone away into the city for work, those bad men could do whatever they wanted. They could take whatever girls they wanted for themselves, and there was no one there to stop them." Luca blinks hard at her. He doesn't want to experience this part. He suddenly dislikes Rebecca's easy magic, the way he can feel those men barging through the forest, their steaming bodies vaporizing the clouds around them as they swipe and stomp their way through the undergrowth. But he can't stop himself from asking the question. "Those bad men, they took you?" "No." Rebecca makes a kind of face that reveals all her straight white teeth, but it isn't a smile, not at all. "We were lucky because we heard the screams coming from our neighbors, because of the way those clouds could trap and funnel the sound, even from far away. So we stopped the fire from making it smoke and we hid. They never found our place." "Oh," Luca feels relieved. But then, after they were gone and we discovered what had happened, that they'd taken 4 girls from our side of the mountain with them, our mami decided that very day that Soledad and I had to leave that place, even though it was the only place we knew in the world. We didn't want to leave it." Luca can feel his face crumpling for her, and he tries to arrange it into an expression of comfort instead of pain. So the next day, Mami walked Soledad and me down the mountain, and she put us on the bus to San Pedro Sula.
Wait, what? She didn't go with you?
Rebecca draws her knees up in front of her and fans herself with the cardboard. She shakes her head. She said nobody would bother two old ladies, so she and the abuela stayed behind. Luca swallows. He doesn't want to ask the next question, but he does.
What happened to them?
I don't know. I haven't seen them since that day. We got to the city. We found our papi at his hotel, and we stayed with him in an apartment that was just a room. It was awful there. So bright and hot and loud, because there was always noise from cars and radios and televisions and people. But papi said we were safer anyway. He liked having us with him, even though we barely saw him because he was working all the time, and he wanted us to start going to school. Was school the same there as it was back home? Rebecca makes a sad smile. No, Luca, nothing was the same. She turns to look over her shoulder at Soledad. But we tried to make the best of it anyway. We never had much schooling at home, or only when we were little, so it was hard for us to catch up. And there weren't many other Indios there, so we felt out of place. We hoped to take the bus back up the mountain some weekends with Papi, so we could visit with Mami and Abuela and our friends, so we could gulp the clouds and refill our spirits. But weeks and then months went by, and Papi was always working, and we never had extra time or money for the bus. And then Sole, she accidentally got a boyfriend. Luca holds up one hand. Wait, how do you accidentally